In this episode of Ideas, I talked to Larry Smith about creativity, passion, his brand new book, and much more. Here's our conversation. Today's guest is Larry Smith. He's a professor of economics at the University of Waterloo in Canada, where he coaches his students to find the careers that they will truly love. He also did an amazing TED Talk called Why You Will Fail to Have a Great Career. And he also wrote a new terrific book, No Fears, No Excuses, What You Need to Do to Have a Great Career. Larry, thank you for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure, Adam.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that intro I just gave to maybe give listeners more of a glimpse into your story?
Certainly. I'm a farm kid, so I spent my earliest childhood in a highly isolated part of rural Ontario where the telephones were still, you crank them to actually make a telephone call. So I've made quite a journey from there to this high-tech university and to a career that I personally thoroughly enjoy. So it's been a long journey.
Very good. So now you being a professor, tell us a little bit about that. How have you made an impact in the lives of your students, would you say?
Well, over all these years, I've been at this game for 30 years. My students have been very generous in their reaction to what I do. If they had not so generously responded with interest to what I was teaching, and of course, I teach labor markets, so of course, I've been always teaching about careers and job opportunities and long-term success. They've always exhibited extreme interest, and they've been kind enough over the years to provide feedback. It's the only reason I actually wrote the book, because unlike other authors about career books, this is not my either personal philosophy or the bios of a few rich people. This is based on the experience of thousands of people who have shared their job aspirations and their job pathways with me for 3 decades. Hmm. So I must have had some impact that's positive. They tell me I have.
Yeah, I love that. A completely different perspective from maybe those that write career books in business. You get to see people from the start. I mean, have you ever had people come back to you later and tell you what an impact? That's got to be rewarding.
Yes, it is rewarding, and it happens frequently. I mean, right now, my experience with respect to jobs are everything from people who are 17 into their mid-50s. So that's quite a range of experience, you might note. And of course, from my point of view, it has been interesting beyond description. I have been stimulated by my students. I have been inspired by them. I have been informed by them. And it's their experience that underlie the book and the guidance that's provided. I know it works because I've watched dozens of people in dozens of different occupations pursue it.
Well, talking about today's students, how have they evolved from students that you've taught in the past? Are you seeing any differences? Is there more of a preference of entrepreneurship? What are some differences, if any?
Well, in some ways, there have been no differences. They're as talented as they ever were, as much energy as they ever had. Their work ethics remain strong. I have basically no complaint with respect to the students I teach in terms of their preparation, a whole range of things. Like many faculty members throughout North America, I, of course, am uneasy about sometimes their rather primitive communication skills. But they were primitive 30 years ago, so they're still not all that great, but that's a skill they can learn. It is certainly the case, as you suggest, that their interest in entrepreneurial endeavor has risen sharply. Now, Waterloo has a strong entrepreneurial culture and has had one from its entire foundation. So my students were always interested in entrepreneurship. It is certainly the case that the proportion of them who want to pursue enterprise has risen significantly over the period of time, as has the quality of the ventures that they are pursuing. Mm-hmm. You know, they become more aggressive. The technologies, if they're doing a tech venture, are better thought out and are pushing the envelope forward more strongly than they might have been tempted to do so in the past. And however, I have some of my older students have been exceptionally successful.
And you mentioned a culture of entrepreneurship. Of course, students are there to learn about business and such. But what has Waterloo done to cultivate that?
Well, there are a number of very distinctive factors, one of which is that the University of Waterloo, all intellectual property rights are to the creator and none to the institution. Mm-hmm. So if you're a faculty member, no matter what you do, your IP belongs to you. If you're a student, all of your IP belongs to you. That's everything from the copyright to your essays to any technology you may create in a laboratory. So there was this, if you can think of something, use it. The institution will take no ownership of in any way, shape, or form. And then for the past several decades, we've been putting in place ever more sophisticated support services to help them But the other thing that is very distinctive and is one of Waterloo's claims to fame is that we have the world's largest cooperative education program, place more than 16,000 students every year, and more than 5,000 employers recruit. And it's the employers who are the iconic companies of North America. It's everything from Microsoft, Intel, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Tesla Motors, all the major financial institutions, all the merchant banks in New York. The list just goes on and on. And this means these young men and women are working in these companies. And by the way, these are not unpaid internships, as many of your U.S. listeners were familiar with. This is paid professional employment, paid full time. And they're on 4 month alternate cycles, 4 months in school, 4 months at an employer, 4 months in school, 4 months at an employer. This means, for example, at the University of Waterloo, if you took four or five students, undergraduates, so these would be people either under 20 or maybe 20, 21. And amongst this, say, 4 to 6 students, you could have a student who's already worked at Facebook and Google. You could have already had students in that small group of people who worked for General Motors, Tesla Motors, Bank of America, Microsoft, and, you know, somebody else. This is a range of industrial experience that you would not find at Harvard at the same age of student. And that has contributed to our entrepreneurial culture. In other words, when you put 19-year-olds out in the workplace and they see what's actually going on, they tend to see opportunities. They tend to see things missing in the marketplace. They tend to see technologies missing. So it is the most intimate kind of exposure to the workplace, which is, of course, where innovation occurs. They sometimes are in companies that are innovators. U.S. universities hire our students as co-op students working in their laboratories in terms of facilitating some of the research, just to give you a sense of the degree of the sophistication of the research. Our co-op programs, by the way, are in both engineering, arts, science, and mathematics. So and then the students, of course, talk to each other and share these experiences. That is a richness of industrial and business experience for young men and women that cannot be rivaled anywhere else on earth. I'm sorry if that sounds like corporate PR, but happens to be factual. And Adam, you and your listeners can check it out. It's all in the public record.
No, I really love that. People coming out of college have a difficult time sometimes even finding a job in their area of expertise. That helps with that. That helps preview students to an area that they might not even like and they think they will. I mean, that does so much. That helps with unemployment. I think more people in the States probably need to look at a setup like that.
Well, you're totally correct in looking at the consequences and effects of it. Many of our students will actually be hired by their co-op employers as they approach graduation, for example. And for some of our startups, their first customers are their co-op employers. They see something that needs to be done. They organize a group of teammates or friends, organize a venture, and then they go to the co-op employer who actually knows them, of course, because they've been hired, and says, would you buy something from us? And that has often, you know, been the spark that will create actually significant scale enterprises. And my former students work everywhere. They're creating enterprises in technology, in the entertainment world, sports-oriented, medical devices, medical-oriented technologies. They do heavy-duty consulting. Some of their ventures work for the United States Department of Defense, providing services. There is a huge array of services being provided. We also have a great strength in engineering and computer science, which means, of course, a lot of the IT stuff Waterloo is involved in, and our students and graduates are fully involved in it.
Now, on the same talk of being a professor, what's some advice that you found you give students repeatedly that may give listeners help in their own businesses along the way? Is there one piece of advice that you find yourself giving repeatedly?
Well, yes, there is. So, Adam, do you want to take the risk of causing all of your listeners to roll their eyes or have an attack of boredom? Because I am going to sound like what I am, and I'm not going to apologize.
Sure.
I tell my students to do their homework. Do research. Don't run amok. I don't care what you're doing. If you're picking a career choice, you make sure you know what is involved in this career choice. Don't come to my office and say, oh, I want to be X. And I say, well, tell me what X involves. Tell me what this occupation involves. Tell me what the educational pathway might be. Tell me what experience you need. And half the time, I regret, their information is incomplete, usually incomplete, and frequently wrong. That is to say, they're going to pursue a career. Venture, same kind of thing. Why do you think this will sell? I ask. And I want a long answer. I want someone to say it will sell because. And I want evidence, not hope, not aspiration. I really, really want it to sell. People will really, really like it. I say, why will they really, really like it? Because they will really, really like it. We get stuck in this like loop, Larry shouts. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry, because I will insist on evidence and logic. I know there are reasons to believe we now live in a world that is post-evidence and post-logic. I don't care about that. In my office, my classroom, and my university, we're going to insist on evidence and logic. And that means work. That means, you know, the classic definition of an entrepreneur, which is, of course, the popular one, not the scholarly one. But entrepreneurs take action. Full speed ahead. Damn the torpedoes. Let's get something done. Let's run up the flagpole and see who salutes. All those cliches. Sorry, enterprise is not a string of cliches if you care to be successful for reasons that do not have anything to do with luck. So we insist on homework. We insist they research their markets. We insist they research their technologies. We insist, for example, that they understand the problem they're trying to solve. Not trip over a problem and 3.5 minutes later think they know how to solve it. It's likely to be a trivial problem that no one really cares about having solved. So that is what I say. I'm sorry it sounds very teacher professorial like, but I don't make apologies for it, Adam, because it's true and the students know it's true already. They are being reminded that there is no magic. I'm an economist. I'm the dismal science, as you know perfectly well. I love your name, of course. You're the name founder of the profession of economics. My profession has a founder. And we don't believe in magic. We want people to use evidence. If there's a market, tell me why. Tell me how big it is. Tell me what the demographic issues are. Tell me what the price points are. There's information. Don't tell me. And of course, the great default is, oh, I'm doing something new, so there's no information. Excuse me. So then we explain why, yes, you should be doing something new, but there's a ton of information that's related to the activity that you're doing. And you go find it first. That's how you get a business plan.
That is great advice. Put in the work. There'll never be a better piece of advice than that.
Well, it's what I've said, and I have no reason to change my mind. Somebody gives me a reason to change my mind, I will, but I have no reason to do so. It is why, of course, unfortunately, there are many ventures in America and Canada, both places, that fail, and they're doomed to fail. And the talent and the effort and the energy and the investment is wasted, and that is a pity, because we need more enterprises, we need more jobs, but we need them to succeed, not to fail. The Brookings Institution in the United States has recently released a report on entrepreneurial activity, and unfortunately, there are more companies closing than being started. And the proportion of older companies in the United States is rising, not falling, which means the proportion of younger companies, newer ones, is shrinking. This is alarming for the future anywhere, and that concerns me. But I see too many things that are just going to fail because the prep is so poor. Now, UW is working hard to change that. I'm not the only one making this argument here at the university, by the way. We are, through all of our support programs, both our graduate ones, we have a Master's of Business Entrepreneurship Technology and the Velocity program, which is our primary incubator accelerator program, we hammer away the same theme. Why do you believe that you're going to be successful? Explain your marketplace. Measure it. And don't tell us you can't. I like numbers too, Adam. I'm an economist. Like, numbers are good things.
You know, this is a perfect segue to talk about your TED Talk video. It sounds like you're fed up with the status quo, as many of us are. Fed up with excuses, as your book title, No Fears, No Excuses, shows. But I just want to hear from you. What inspired you to do that TED Talk?
Well, I did it simply because a student was organizing the first TEDx talk at the University of Waterloo and said to me, would I be one of the speakers? I like helping students, and if they make a sensible request, I was aware of the importance of the TED Talks and the reach of their audience. And so it seemed to me very important that we have a TEDx talk at the University of Waterloo that would serve, you know, that would draw on the university's communities and students to as speakers and also share the information and the knowledge that the TED is renowned for doing. And the student pointed out, because I am a high-profile faculty member because I've taught 10% of the alumni of the university, that would help him if I would be one of the speakers. So, you know, why would I say no? I'm a professor. I'm paid per word. So this meant I could say more words. That was a joke, by the way. I've tried to get my dean to agree to it. I've tried to get my dean to agree, Adam, and it's non-starter. If it was per word, I'd be the highest-paid faculty member at the university. So, and that's why I did it. Now, But then the issue, of course, was the topic. Of course, I do all this career stuff, so it seemed logical that the topic should be about career. And you're exactly correct. I have been frustrated by people making excuses. Every excuse that's in the TED video, I have heard. Those millions of views didn't come by accident. They came, I believe, because most people recognize the excuses. Either their family or friends had used them, or their excuses the individual himself or herself had used. So it's about as authentic as you can get, arising from, again, these thousands of conversations I've had about career. So I just took my frustrations about listening to these same reasons not to take action, not to develop their talent. And I just put them together. And then I said what I believe to be true. You will fail to have a great career if you can't get past this stuff. You're your own worst enemy. You're building your own box. It's a cage, actually, not a box. And then you throw away the key. I view that as tragic. So I vented some of my frustrations. That was okay, too. Added my mental health, because I'm concerned about my own mental health, not just other people.
And, you know, you were very passionate in the way that you delivered. Passion comes up in the conversation. What is passion to you?
Well, I do believe it is the basis of the definition of all the passionate people I know. Again, I'd reiterate, I try not to make this based on my personal experiences because they may not be representative. I'll answer the question, but I want to do it based also on all the other passionate women I have been privileged to meet in wildly different fields. So there are some common themes of passion. And you know, I'm going to use a phrase that I didn't invent, but it's a really good one, so I don't feel the need to be original. I just feel the need to attribute it to somebody else. I only knew who it was. And that was, you cannot stop thinking about the thing you love. So there are criteria of what constitutes passion. So interested, you cannot stop thinking about it. So interesting, you cannot stop reading about it. I had a student who once was pursuing a venture that was not a good one. And I asked him, I said, this is a poor venture. It has limited chance to be successful. And you seem to have no interest in what the nature of the business is. Why don't you start a business in a topic you care about?
Yeah.
Not just, yeah, you want to start a business, so you're excited about that. But you better be excited about the product, market, or technology that your enterprise is going to be about. And he had actually another passionate interest. Well, an interest, he thought. He came back to see me 2 weeks later with a file folder an inch thick, saying he'd been doing research on his new market and he wanted to discuss it. And then he apologized for bringing so much stuff to talk about because he said, quote, when I started, he was referring to the research, when I started doing the research, I couldn't stop. That's passion, where you can't stop. Another cliche, but it's also true. It is what you would do even if you won the law. Lottery. I'm not going to leave the university if I won a lottery. Don't buy tickets, so I guess I'm not going to win. But it would actually make no difference for me. Well, maybe I'd buy an airplane so I could commute to my country home, but I'd still be here. And that's what it is. So strong an interest. You have to pull yourself away from it. And that means, of course, Monday, Saturday, Sunday. The days don't matter because you have fun every day. You don't live for the weekend. 5 days, live for the weekend. You know, TGIF, thank God it's Friday. Oh my word, I hate the phrase. I hate the idea that stands behind the phrase. So one element of passion is so interesting you cannot stop yourself, or that you have trouble stopping yourself. Yep. You really should eat and sleep and have a family life and those good things too. But the other element of passion is that you got to fix something in it.
Right.
Because passionate people bring an intensity of interest and they see weaknesses. The vaguely interested never do. They see issues to be resolved that someone just being a good soldier at work will never see. And even if the boss said, yo, look at this thing, fix it. They will never fix it if it's a big problem. So passion is intensely connected to innovation. So if there's something you can't stop reading about or talking about or thinking about, and if as part of that talking, thinking, and reading, you keep thinking, whoa, why doesn't someone fix that? You have a passion. And that means, of course, your talent, if you engage that passion, will be to create wonderful things.
I love that. That is so good. There's much fulfillment found in that.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, Adam, it's like an athlete, and you know you're at the limit of what you can do. My, that is a wonderful feeling, to know that whatever you will do with your life, you're getting as close to the maximum impact you will ever have. And that is profoundly fulfilling, just as you said.
Yeah, and one quote that sticks out from your video for me is, wasted talent is a waste I cannot stand. And it sounds like you focus a lot on lessening the amount of regret that each of us experience. Is this ultimately why finding our passion is so important? Not only regret, but to impact the most amount of people as we can on this earth.
Yes, it is. I'm an economist, and I'm a happy economist, right? So it's not just my occupation or my profession. It's the way I think about things. I'm passionate about economics because it is, to me, doesn't have to be for everybody, but to me, it's a philosophy of life. And economics is about efficiency, which is don't waste anything. Don't waste natural resources. Don't waste the environment, the planet. Don't waste technology and don't waste your time. Your time is, of course, don't waste your money, but really don't waste your time. Your time is more precious. Your time is more scarce. You can find money, but you can't find time. That hour once gone is gone forever. So it seems to me that we all should be trying to maximize the amount we get done, the amount of impact we have in the time we have. And then I see people because they're doing work that they're not productive at because they really don't care about the result all that much. Then I watch the passionate person and he gets like five times as much done in half the time. And that's the point. I see waste everywhere. I have a visceral emotional aversion to it. I get motivated and also despair with this one thought. What would our world be like? I try to imagine. If every person on the planet was working at the limit of their talent, it might, Adam, not be paradise, but it would be much, much better place than it is at this moment.
That's beautiful.
But yeah, it keeps me going. But on the other hand, we are so far from that. That means we live in a world with more problems, disaster, death, unhappiness. It lists all the horrors that people on the world deal with. And they could be much reduced if we were all at the limit of our capabilities, I believe.
This is great to talk about. People need to find their passion. People need to find a passion to become passionate about people. If you can't find your passion, become passionate about helping people. Go help somebody with the strengths you already have within you. That's my belief.
Well, and I would just add, because I agree completely with you, it is that I'm on this program because I would like to contribute to your ability to impact people. Well, I'm really trying to help people, and you're providing a way to help people that I strongly support. And it's quite right. You can be passionate about different things. You can be passionate about a subject area like history. You can be passionate about a marketplace, and some people are. You can be passionate about the outdoors, and you can be passionate about helping people. But it's passion, not just liking it a little bit. Sometimes a student, when I say, what are you interested? They say, I'm not sure. And I say, cool, you're 20. How could you not have something you like? And sometimes they will say, I like to help people. And I say, well, that's a good start. Tell me how. And the truth is, it is not a passion interest. They haven't thought about it enough because they have no answer. How do you want to help them? Wonderful that you want to help them. Tell me how. And you see, there I wonder that it's a passion. It might be if they thought about it enough, but to have no passion applies to helping people, totally as you said. But I want it to be done with passion, commitment, creativity, pushing the envelope. I've met some journalists, extraordinary men and women, who believe they're in a war with ignorance. And they're like warriors to get the truth out, sometimes battling their editors as much as they do anyone else, as well as reluctant interview subjects and every other obstacle they have. Plus, of course, the public's aversion to anything that might be like, you know, what's that word, truth. And then, of course, there are the others who couldn't think of anything to do, and journalism seemed cool. Two categories of people. That first category are heroes in our world, and we need more of them. The others, a neutral effect, at best.
Would you agree that those people that aren't passionate, many times they look to other people for their passion and think that it sounds cool? They find other people's passion and not their own?
That's right.
You would agree with that?
Absolutely. I've seen it happen where, you know, people imitate their friends, they imitate their family. But if you ask them some questions, it's a facade. It crumbles. I will ask, why do you tell me this field is of interest to you? And it really will come down to it. And on occasion, the honest person will admit, well, it's the only thing I know about. To which the professor says, perhaps you should learn about other things. No, but again, you see, they are trapped by their own past experiences. My goodness, when you're 20, how much past experience could you have? And I had a very background because I was living in the country and I had family members who ran sawmills and we killed cows and like did a huge range of things. So I've got a lot of different kinds of experiences and I work with machinery and I drive tractors and do all of that like farm stuff, right? Highly varied. Yeah, I'm dumb as a doorpost. Well, again, I was too young to know very much. So I had some things I liked as a kid. I thought my teachers didn't teach very well. So I actually didn't like school because eventually I persuaded myself that what I really like is better teaching. So there was some precursor, the passion I have for teaching now, but it was still tentative because I didn't know very much. So I knew about teaching because I had to go to school. But over time, you learn more. That's how you figure out what is a passion and how you find your own, not somebody else's. I still stand with William Shakespeare. To thine own self be true. And I'll follow the day, the night, you cannot be false to anyone else. It's what I believe. That's why Willie is such a powerful guy, 400 years. But if you talk about the old virtues, those old ideas are still true. They were true 400 years ago. They'll be true 400 years forward. And I'm supposed to be teaching universal truth, not just old techie things.
It goes back to the advice you gave at the beginning of this conversation of passion, that piece that you can't stop thinking about. And that's being true to yourself, finding your own passion. I mean, that's the advice. What can you not stop thinking about? Not what somebody else can't stop thinking about.
Precisely.
Moving on to your book, a great book, by the way, No Fears, No Excuses. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, what ended up happening after the video, whose, you know, viewership, like, whoa, completely surprised me. And then, of course, email exploded. People know how to find me on the in our virtual world, so they did. And they quite rightly asked more questions, because in 15 minutes, I said, if you do these things, you're going to be a loser.
Yeah.
Or sorry, if you don't do things, you're going to be a loser. And of course, the video ended with, you know, failed to have a great career unless, and I sort of stopped there. A, because there was no more time, and B, I intended to stop there. I wanted to provoke thought. Yeah, well, I did provoke thought, more thought than I thought I was going to provoke. And then on top of all that, they sent me emails, like strangers, people just not, I mean, I got some from former students, but I largely got mail from people who never knew me, just except for the TED video. I mean, I've taught 23,000 people, not 23 million. And so these are people who don't know me. And they kept asking questions. They want, okay, now what should I do? How do I find my passion? How do I overcome my fears? Okay, I am afraid. I admit that. You said fear will stop you. I'm afraid. How do I not be afraid? So I started answering them. I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. So I'm answering and I'm answering and answering. And at that stage of the game, of course, the literary agents began calling and said, did I want to write a book? Because they were sure there would be publishers who would be interested. And at that stage of the game, I had a third of the book written in all these emails. Plus, I now knew what questions to answer that were specific, right? Because I had hundreds and hundreds of people asking very specific questions that were themes, sort of groups of questions. So, in fact, the viewers of the TED video set the agenda for the book. Then I simply drew on the thousands of conversations I've had to provide the examples. The structure comes in the dialogue from the TED. The content comes from thousands of conversations for 30 years, including, as we talked about, the feedback that I get decades after. And partly, it's also driven, even though this took a lot of time. Writing a book is an endeavor. I'm not quite sure I'm going to recommend it to anyone. But I had to write it once this opportunity was open to me, because I had to get it out of my head. Like, really, truly. And the TED video persuaded me that even more people were struggling with career than I had imagined. And that was, the number of people who viewed it was depressing, because the people viewing it, they're viewing it because they know in their hearts that they, at best, have an okay career, but not a great one. And the sense they're missing something. Well, of course, if they think they're missing something, then they are. I mean, if you're not satisfied in your career, by definition, it's not a great career, period. End of. The individual is the decider of this, not me. And all of the guidance in the book about do these things have a great career, it's the person having the career tells me it's a great career, not Larry saying, okay, well, you get a great career, so I'll use this advice in the book. I did not ever. A person whose example I'm providing had either a bad career by their own description or a great career by their own description. Now, there were very common themes to this, by the way, but I still defer to the judgment of the individual, not to some me trying to make up some criteria.
Right. And I mean, that goes back to the discussion of talking about bad careers, going back to the discussion of passion. People are looking for a perfect job, but the missing link is passion. It all goes back to that.
Absolutely. Well, I met plumbers. So there's some pointy-headed people who think plumbing is like a poor job that uneducated people do. Well, if they're uneducated, though, your house will blow up from methane gas backing up to begin with. Secondly, I know plumbers who love what they do because the logic of what they're doing, they're in the front lines of keeping society healthy. Mm-hmm. They are. We have safe water and we have a safe disposal of sewage, or we're up to our ankles in disease. And I can use a more vivid word if you wish, but I'm going to decline because I'm Canadian. I'm too nice to do that.
For
example, I'm my plumber, and he loves plumbing. He will tell me about valves. He will tell me more about valves than I wish to know. But I know two things. One, he's fixing whatever needs to be fixed, and it's not likely to have to be fixed again. And he's telling me about all these different valves and the way they work and the way they don't work, because he's fascinated by those valves. And he launched virtually, you know, lyrical about this valve not having to be replaced because it doesn't have a seal and it will... He knows everything. I know gardeners who, when they stand and look at a beautiful garden there, as excited, and that's impact on the world. They bring beauty into the world. They care about the beauty, and the people who see it say, you have given me a beautiful moment in a hectic day. And so I agree with you completely. This is not about a occupation. It is about how you react to an occupation. For example, we have at the university a whole range of, you know, support services. We have retail services, you know, retail stores, you know, selling books, selling supplies, selling the things. You know, we have 30,000 people on the campus, so they need stuff. They need food. They need a whole bunch of other things. Yet the best of these frontline people, and we have a lot of these good people, what they think they're doing is helping students. They're not retail clerks. They're dealing with vulnerable young people who are buying something and probably don't quite have enough money to pay for it, or are hurting to pay for it. And those men and women, their passion is helping people, helping young people in particular. And they do it through providing high quality retail services. That's not about moving the customer through fast to maximize the rate of return of the university. Make sure that kid bought the right thing, the right book, and he's buying a t-shirt, and it's what he needs, what he wants, and does not live to regret the decision. That's another way that you get a high-quality society, where you improve the level of the experience of everyone, including when you go in to buy a t-shirt. Try doing that in the regular shopping mall. Some of them do it well, and I salute them.
Right. And so many people look for those huge moments to make an impact, and it can be found in the small everyday moments. In your book, you discuss the topic of innovation, something that I am passionate about. What are some basic tips you can give listeners to become more creative with their work?
Okay, I'm going to again be boring. Practice. If you found your passion, you're going to be led naturally to want to innovate. Doesn't actually mean you can do it, right? But that's a good start. Passionate people bring this intensity of focus, which means they tend to be very observant, which of course is also a good thing when you're trying to solve a difficult problem. So they will naturally be observant. That's a good thing. They have a desire to do it because it's like actively annoying them because they care about something, or they care about a garden or a piece of software. Whoa, this piece of software. I have a student, oh, this software. Oh, it's a horrible piece of software. It's elegant. It's awkward. It's clunky. They're prone to failure. I mean, they can barely talk about it. They're so disgusted with it. You can see why they're going to try to fix it. However, it doesn't change the fact that you have to learn how to do it successfully, not just want to do it. And the thing that is encouraging, there are a lot of things to be discouraged about. One thing to be encouraged about is that I've never met a healthy child, like a little kid, 4 or 5, 6 even, who didn't have an active imagination. You just get down on the carpet. You have to be on the on the floor with the kid. You know, 3-year-old playing with a toy. Look into the kid's face. Oh, he's looking at the toy, but he's in another world. He's in a world of his own imagination. It's not a truck on a hardwood floor or a car. That truck is going down the highway. That truck is in the forest. That truck, God knows where that truck is, but the kid and the truck and the environment are in another place. If you look carefully, you sometimes see the kid's eyes aren't even focused. And by the way, if you're sitting down there, the kid may totally ignore you. Of course, because you're not in his imaginary space. Now, if we can all be imaginative like that when we're young, you know pretty well what happens. We grow up. Our parents tell us to stop daydreaming. Our teachers tell us, be quiet and sit still and learn how to read. Now, by the way, I'm in favor of learning how to read. I think counting is a good plan. So, of course, you have to impose structure, rules. We need them. We can't think without them. We can't communicate without them. But while we get so busy teaching the kid how to read, his imagination is either squelched or simply atrophies from disuse. As more and more structure is piled upon him, pick up your underwear, shower, eat your carrots. And then finally, they do most of those things. Oh, they bitch about some of them. But at the end of the day, they become rule-bound. Prisoners of conventional thought. Then they end up in my classroom thinking they know what economics is about. We destabilize them in the first 10 minutes. Okay, totally wrong about that. Let's start again. How do you become imaginative like a kid? Oh, well, I don't know. Start being imaginative again. You had this skill when you were 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
Well, find it again. And it's going to take practice because you've practiced imposing rules on your head. Now you're going to have to practice pushing the rules to one side, not ignoring them, obviously, and building imaginative experiences. Well, for one thing, stop eating the same breakfast cereal every morning. Why must you get up in the morning and have oatmeal? Yes, yes, oatmeal's good for you, but you really don't need oatmeal every day. It's okay, every day eat something new. Every day walk down a different street. The sheep-like behavior of people is startling. On a freeway or a major highway, it's like ridiculous. Busy time. There are service centers, you know, where people have to go for gasoline and to relieve themselves. And of course, on a busy like holiday weekend, my goodness, getting in and out of a service center to get gas and to some refreshment or relief for yourself can be like half hour, and you're taking a 2-hour trip and half of it's stuck in this chaos place. I watch this all the time. To my goodness, half a mile away, visible from the major highway, is not a service center, but is a service station with a restaurant. And there's nobody there because everyone goes to the obvious place. And the slightly less obvious place nobody goes to. Well, me and my family, we go there. In and out in 15 minutes with a hot dog. And I can look down and see cars that left the road at the same time are still in the line. They haven't even actually got off the ramp. Like, why do people do that? There is a piece of construction going on here in Waterloo. They're rebuilding one of the major highways, an arterial road that leads to the main controlled access highway, main what you would call freeway here. And of course, there's traffic jams every morning because of the construction. That's just inevitable. You reduce lanes. And there are two access points to this highway. One, the one that is being undergoing all the construction, which you can get stuck for a half hour. And every morning, the radio tells me there is congestion at the access point to the main highway. Yet there's two access points. Why aren't people taking the second access point? They're taking the obvious one, getting stuck there for a half hour. If you take the non-obvious one, Adam, it's like 4 kilometers away. kilometers, you know, Canadian miles, right? And of course, I take the other one. Boom, I'm through. So this thing about being creative is start practicing. Think about, do you really have to go to, is that the only access point to that highway? Of course, if you thought about it for 12 seconds, you think, oh, of course it's not. And even if the other one's slightly out of the way, I'm going to lose so much time in this stupid. And of course, you know the people who are stuck in this line? They're the commuters who do it every day.
Right.
So they have no excuse for not knowing. You know, dress slightly differently. Talk to somebody new. Talk about a subject to someone, like a subject. If you're passionate about things, you found your passion. Well, talk about your passion to people. If they're not interested, find someone who is interested. It is about, it's like actively recreating a commitment to do different things. So eating, you know, Wheaties instead of oatmeal in the morning hardly might, you know, create, you know, a breakthrough in biomedical engineering, or maybe it will long term. So how do you be innovative? Start somewhere and start having thoughts that aren't the same thoughts you had for the last 50 years. Reorganize the furniture in your house. Dig up your backyard and plant a tree and imagine new possibilities. It gets easier. The people who've done this tell me in the beginning it near killed them because they had to acknowledge they were habit machines. And if the artificial intelligence can replace us, it'll replace that part of us. We're so dopey we can't eat something different for breakfast because it destabilizes our lives. Whoa. Drink apple juice and orange juice. You really just try it. Anything. Mix it up.
In your book, you also dismiss the idea of luck. We often even say good luck in the future or good luck in your future endeavors. I mean, it's become a saying, if you will. How do you explain when good things happen then? And do you believe that everything is within our control?
No, not everything is within our control. I wanted to play basketball in high school, but I'm not tall enough. That didn't happen. No, I'm not. So that didn't happen. I mean, there was discrimination against those who are height challenged, and I had to just live with that, right? So no, we can't control everything. We can't have everything we want. We don't live in a world of magic. And sometimes lucky things happen. Sometimes money falls from heaven and hits you on the head. Well, if that happens, grab it. If a miracle job falls into your lap because someone said, oh, here's this job, why don't you apply? You applied it mindlessly and suddenly discovered, my God, this is the only thing I want to do with the rest of my life. That's accidental. That's luck. Well, fine. First, you have to be alert to make sure you notice that you have got the ideal job. So it's not just pure luck, you know. Luck's, you know, the old, again, cliche that luck is, you know, 1% luck and 99% preparation. So you actually knew that you were being lucky, as if this is the right thing you wanted to do. But I object to relying on that, which is what most people do, I'm afraid. I know good luck is like a social convention cliche thing, but society's words reflect how society thinks about things. All too common. So good luck. Why would you say to a student, good luck before an exam? That's ridiculous, right? Because it's not luck. It is, the kid should have worked. I will wish my students success. Because that's true. I do wish they shall be successful. They wish they should be successful too, but I'm not going to say, I hope luck rescues you because you're such an idiot.
Right.
Like, I am offended. I don't know if it's going to happen in Rio again. Your listeners might pay attention to it. But the last several Olympics, you know, the spectacular opening day ceremonies, which are, you know, theater usually in most openings. And I doubt Rio will be any different. And, you know, there's the March of the Athletes. Colorful, powerful, some of the best athletes in the planet are now going to try to do their personal bests. And if there was ever a place with a lot of passionate people, it is the Olympics. Because of passion, you've not gotten there. And then in the last several Olympics, the last thing the voiceover announcer says in both official languages of the Olympics, we wish our athletes good luck. Now, if I'd spent 5 years in brutal training, competition, for whatever sport, doesn't matter, and I heard someone wish me good luck, I mean, the only thing you can tell me is, if I'm a runner, that you hope I don't trip when I start. It undervalues the commitment that a passionate person puts in. And when you say luck, it means, well, don't have to plan too much, because even if you plan, don't plan, it doesn't matter, it's all a matter of luck. It is the greatest excuse of all time, right? If he's successful by luck, then what's the plan? Maybe I'll be successful, maybe not. Although, oddly enough, as soon as you're successful, suddenly you become a genius. Oh, yeah, I earned the success. 3 minutes earlier, I thought it was luck. Of course, the other guy who was successful, he was just lucky. I'm a genius. The stupidity of that boggles me. So, yeah, I will not wish people luck. Of course, the irony is if you wish luck to an idiot, he wouldn't even know you've insulted him. Well, perfect irony, that couldn't be a good example. But I want people to take charge of their lives. No, not everything is under our control, but a lot is. And I think we can both agree that if you just abstain from exercising any control and wait for the fates to rescue you, most of the time they will not.
It undermines the effort.
Absolutely. And then you're just adrift. And most things adrift drift onto the rocks. And in today's competitive world, the rocks are never been sharper.
This is true. I really enjoyed our conversation today, Larry. What's one last piece of advice that you want to leave listeners with today?
Well, I'll be predictable again. In the chaos of the world around us, please be thoughtful. I just want people to be thoughtful, to look for reasons why they're doing things. And it's about being true to yourself. How can you be true to yourself if you deny your talent and don't work to develop? Well, first to find it, develop it, and use it. And be thoughtful. This is one of life's great decisions.
Love it. Love it. Where can people find your work?
The book, No Fears, No Excuses, What You Need to Do for a Great Career is available. Everywhere you should find books. So regular bookstores, there's ebooks. Amazon, of course, has everything. There are audiobooks as well as ebooks as well as physical books. You order them from different countries and get them in different formats too for whatever peculiar reason. So yeah, it's just been published in April. So it's readily available and Amazon will of course, bring it to your doorstep should you find going to a store too scary an experience.
Awesome. Thank you again for coming on the show, Larry. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too, Adam. Thank you very much for inviting me. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you got something out of these ideas. Go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss an episode.